When we think about the internet and the history of the internet, what do we think about? Do we think just about North America, or more specifically, do we just think about the United States? But what if I told you that 15 years before most people in the United States got online and started using what was called the internet, there were millions of people in France, of all places, who were connected, who were being social, who were buying things online with this government-backed technology? Well, that's what we're talking about today, and we're talking about the book Minitel, Welcome to the Internet, by Julian Mailand and Kevin Driscoll. It's important to note for this interview that there are two actual interviews in one. I was able to interview Julian earlier and prior to the FCC's recent vote on the open internet rules. And I was able to interview Kevin after the vote by the FCC. This is New Books in Technology. I'm your host, Jasmine McNeely. So the book is Minitel, Welcome to the Internet. And I'm here with Julian Mailand, who's one of the authors of the book. And first, one of the first things we like to do on New Books in Technology is to get a sense of who we're talking to. So tell me, who is Julian Mailand?
Sure. So I'm an assistant professor in the media school at Indiana University. I'm a lawyer as well, and I do research on internet law and policy. And I try to approach this from a variety of angles, including social constructivism, the law, but also comparative theory. I find there's a lot of value in comparing what different countries are doing for thinking about where we should take the internet. And so that's kind of the focus of my research. And as of the topic of the book, Minitel was a French network that started in the early 80s, and I happened to have grown in France. So I was actually a user back then.
Mm-hmm. So why write the book?
Well, you know, there's kind of this myth in Silicon Valley that the internet really started, you know, in the Bay Area, and it's kind of this American-made network, and that there's nothing else outside of the internet, right? And that online world or cyberspace today is kind of the direct descendant of the ARPANET. And that's not true. And it's really too bad that internet histories in general and, you know, the body of work on law and policy, on internet law and policy in the U.S. is so U.S.-centric, because we can actually learn a lot from looking at what's been going on in different countries since the 60s. And so with the book, what we're doing is looking at a network that started in the late 70s and ended in 2012. And the reason we called it Minitel, Welcome to the Internet, is that the book isn't about talking about Minitel for its own sake. It's about looking at the Minitel example and figure out what we can learn from that experience to think about internet policy for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so this is why the book is relevant today, even though the network doesn't exist anymore. But it's relevant because we're at a crossroad where some very, very important policy decisions have to be made. AgitPi is about to roll out or cancel net neutrality in a couple of days. And so those experiences that people went through in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s, I think are very, very relevant today for helping us think about things like net neutrality and about platform governance. At a time where more and more our lives are mediated by platforms like Facebook or Google or Amazon.
Well, you know, you mentioned a lot of things I want to talk to you further about. But one of the first things you mentioned was the very American or U.S.-centric history or mythology that's told about the internet and online, like communities and sociality. And why do you think that is?
I mean, I think it's an easy tendency for people to not look outside of our borders, right? So that's one of the reasons. The second reason I think is that, you know, there might be a political tendency for a lot of people to think, okay, what went on in Europe is irrelevant for us. We don't like government. We don't like Europe. And therefore, we're not going to look at what Europe does because it's not relevant for us. Europe or other countries, by the way, there's been great books written about, you know, the internet in Russia, the internet in Chile. And the other tendency, I think, is that it's, you know, it's easy for, it's nice and it's self-satisfying for Silicon Valley to say, hey, we're the middle of the world, we're the center of the world, we invented everything, right? It's kind of nice to pat oneself on the back. So I think that that is the main reason why.
So let's get into that. The Minitel was a project of the French government, right?
Correct.
And just that fact that it was government or government-backed innovation, does that seem to be a major sticking point when people criticize?
Yes. And I think there's this idea, you know, in the U.S., we distrust the government so much relative to other countries that I think a lot of people get the idea that government intervention in itself is bad, right? And then they kind of stop looking there. When you go to conferences like TPRC, which I know you go to, or I think you go, you know, people seem to say, okay, Minitel was government back, and therefore it was centralized, it was closed, it was government controlled, all the content was controlled by the government. But that's not true at all, because in fact what happened was the government set up the platform, but all the services were privately run, right? So yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things that struck me is just how advanced Minitel was. So you had the beginnings of e-commerce and chatting and the social aspects, but you also had, you know, routes for activism, like forerunners for activism that we see happening today. I'm thinking of the student strike that used Minitel. So I wonder if you could talk about that, just like how the Minitel was such a forerunner to all of the things that we perhaps take for granted now.
Sure. So yeah, it was an exciting technology, and you know, it's derided today for being so slow, but at the time, you know, computer networks in the US were the exact same speed, right? Because modems were modems. Yeah, they were, you know, at its peak in about 92, so before most Americans had even ever heard of the internet, they were about 30,000 services. And a lot of these, as you mentioned, were really the kind of the forerunner of the, that we think, you know, was invented in Silicon Valley back in 1995. So we have a whole chapter about it. And it was pretty fun. So, for example, you know, before there was E-Trade, you could trade stock online, right? Which in the U.S. in the 80s, very, very few people could do, right? Mm-hmm. Only the very wealthy, right? There's this scene in the Trading Places movie with Eddie Murphy where the evil bankers are in the back of their car and they're placing trades through their telephone. And that was something that very hurt you people. You know, before you could order food online back in Paris in the 80s, you could order food for, you know, delivery, immediate delivery. You could play online games and interactive games. And of course, kind of the most infamous of those services were the chat rooms, right? And a lot of these chat rooms were used, and they were, you know, monitored, but it didn't, certainly did not prevent activism from taking place. As you mentioned, some of the big student demonstrations in 1986 were organized through those chat rooms. So, you know, and they look something similar to Usenet or things like that in the U.S. And of course, a lot of it was used for what's called a pink Minitel or Minitel, which was, you know, a form of sexy chat. So it wasn't porn because there were no images, but it was kind of sex chat that went from kind of lighthearted masquerade type thing to much more hardcore chat. So that was a big feature of Minitel. And in fact, back in the 80s, the streets of France were covered with ads for those sexy chat rooms. Yeah, so it was an exciting thing, you know, which if you remember the excitement that we felt in the US starting in 95 when people started going on the web, right? So it was a similar excitement except 10 years before that.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things we mentioned, we talk about the chat rooms, and so we get to the idea of community that was built and available. Was a community that you could find on Minitel, or the various communities, I should say, you could find on Minitel, is that any different than what we see with Twitter or Tumblr or any of the other social media apps that we have out today?
It's hard to tell. I mean, it was certainly different in a number of ways. You couldn't really follow people. I mean, there was an email system, but other than that, it was kind of instantaneous. You know, whomever was in the chat room was there to chat with. So in that sense, it's different from Twitter or Facebook because you didn't have, you know, a list of friends. But I mean, I think certainly in a lot of ways, it was a precursor to that, and so it, in a lot of ways it resembled it. Some people, there's a lot of stories of people actually meeting other people online and then going and dating in real life. So in a lot of ways, it's also a precursor to some of the dating apps that we use today, except, you know, people didn't have pictures, so you had to use the power of your words to lure people into actually meeting you.
Yeah. And it was very fraught with peril in case you you didn't get the person you thought you were going to get.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So one of the things we've been talking about with Minitel and in this present day, and you mentioned the FCC and the possible vote coming up soon in the United States. I was wondering, like, if you could talk about ideas of net neutrality and some of the debates related to net neutrality and the lessons from Minitel that we could possibly or that are possibly relevant to our understanding of net neutrality and perhaps the need for net neutrality.
Sure. So, you know, in the US, it seems that the debate focuses a lot fundamentally around whether or not we want government intervention in networks, right? And opponents of net neutrality claim that basically any sort of government intervention will slow down the internet, will hinder innovation, right? Which is ironic considering the original internet in the US was paid for by our tax dollars. Mm-hmm. But aside of that, you know, I remember, for example, around the first debate around net neutrality that led to the order, the open internet order, Ted Cruz tweeted something along the lines of net neutrality is Obamacare for the internet. We don't want an internet operating at the speed of government, right? And that really echoes the arguments of very large internet service providers like Comcast or Verizon, who, you know, wave a red flag and say, look, government intervention will slow down the internet. Well, the Minitel experience shows us that government intervention, if it is targeted and if it is done well, can actually support innovation, right? And so the case of Minitel is a case in point for showing this. And so in the French case, what happened was the government paid for the network, right? The platform, basically the pipes that in the US are operated by companies like Comcast and Verizon. And then the government said, okay, pretty much anyone now can connect to those pipes and provide services as long as they are lawful. And that really catalyzed private innovation, right? Because the network was there, paid for by the French taxpayer. But then anyone with a good idea could go and promote it. And the operator, because it was the basically the phone company, the Post Telephone and Telegraph Administration, because it was the state, it had to operate as a common carrier, right? And because it had to operate as a common carrier, as long as your service was lawful, was legal, it couldn't block it or prioritize one over the other, right? And that is what made innovation possible, right? So now, when you look at the debate on net neutrality, what the internet order does, the open internet order that guarantees net neutrality because it classified the internet service providers as carriers, it does pretty much the same thing that the French system did, which is that it promotes innovation by enabling anyone who wants to provide a service over the internet to do it without having to pay extra to Comcast, or without having your service blocked because Comcast or Verizon don't like it, or because they want to promote their own service instead, right? So the French example shows you that government intervention, when it's well done, and when it ensures net neutrality, actually catalyzes innovation rather than hinder. So I think it's a good case study to show and to rebut the argument of conservative politicians and very large conglomerates who say that government intervention will slow down the internet. It's simply not true.
And one of the arguments or points of discussion in the net neutrality debate is that without net neutrality, certain segments of society, particularly poor people and people of color, marginalized groups, may not have access to information that they otherwise need access to, right? And I thought it's interesting that Minitel was free, that the government gave these to users. And so there was no real, in that way, there was no real dichotomy between people who had a lot of money and people who didn't. And I was wondering if you could talk about the possible effects that had, that people were kind of on a level playing field as far as access to this innovation.
Sure. And that's definitely one of the very kind of French characteristics of that network. In the 80s in the United States, very few people were online because PCs were expensive. And because of that, very few services were created, right? We never hit that kind of critical mass of users that would then attract a content provider that would then attract more users, right? That didn't happen in the US until 1995. But in France, as you mentioned, the state subsidized the system, just like, by the way, the federal government subsidized the internet by building ARPANET and then NSFNET. So certainly that the subsidization, in particular in the form of free terminals, right? So as you mentioned, the way it worked is that starting in 1983, you would go to the post office and the post office would give you a free computer. It wasn't a very powerful computer. It couldn't really do anything on its own, but it could get you online, right? Mm-hmm. So it ended up that basically everyone in France, even people who couldn't afford PCs, ended up with a computer in their home and were able to go online. So I think that was a great equalizer in a sense. However, on kind of the opposite side of that, you got to remember that Minitel was very, very expensive, right? Because you had to pay by the minute. So it was free to get a terminal, but then you had to pay by the minute, just like you had to pay in the U.S., and it was also very expensive in the U.S. So in terms of, very active users in the chat rooms, that demographic was mostly young, rich urbanites, right? I think the equivalent would be in today's life, you know, would be the Facebook or the Google employees, right? that gentrify cities like San Francisco at very rapid pace. So the people used it a lot were that, but you're right. If you didn't use it very much, you still had access to lots of information that you couldn't otherwise have had access to because you couldn't afford a PC, right? And as you mentioned, a lot of the marginalized communities that didn't have really anywhere to get together and exchange information became big internet users, right? So for example, remember it was the 80s, the HIV epidemic was in full-blown, and so the gay community started using Minitel a lot for exchanging information and things like that. And so marginalized communities definitely benefited from this quite a bit because they could, you know, get access to information they couldn't get access to, or they could meet with people like them without having to be, you know, doing it in public where they might not feel safe about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So one of the things that we always like to do on New Books in Technology is allow you to do an elevator pitch. That is, if you had a minute to tell people why they should read or buy your book, what would you say?
Well, people should read the book because we are at a crossroads where the internet of tomorrow is being determined by today's policy debate. Mm-hmm. And that policy debate has been obfuscated by political arguments, by lies that are repeated over and over again by the very large ISPs like Comcast and Verizon. And in order to debunk these arguments and to think better about net neutrality and what the future of the internet should be, we have to look outside of our borders. We have to look at history. We have to look at other case studies. And Minitel is a case study that shows you that targeted government intervention can, when it's well done, support innovation, and that a targeted government intervention in the form of imposing net neutrality actually leads to great innovation.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So what's next?
Well, I think that the next side of net neutrality, one of the really important issues today is think about the governance of platforms. By platforms, I mean electronic systems that mediate our lives, right? Where we meet, where we exchange, where we buy, where we discuss politics, where we share our lives. So platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, Google, that not only mediate our life, but also get a whole lot of information about us, right? The question of how these platforms should, if at all, be regulated is very important because, you know, if a platform does not have any sort of obligation to act in a public interest, then it might become a problem, right? So when the Constitution of the United States was drafted, when the Bill of Rights was drafted, our worry was that the government would control our lives, right? And so that's why the framers, for example, wrote this one thing called the First Amendment that says government cannot infringe on your freedom of speech, right? But that's at a time where if you were a political activist, you know, a lot of times you would go on a soapbox in a public forum, right? So it was important to make sure that the government could not infringe on this. And that's why the First Amendment was drafted with the government intervention in mind. But nowadays, where it gets tricky is that our new forum has become an electronic forum, right? If you're an activist, you're not going to go on your soapbox on the public square. I mean, you might, but you're not going to have very good impact, right? You're going to go on Facebook, you're going to go on Twitter. And where that becomes a problem is that these companies, because they're privately held, are not subject to the First Amendment, and they can do pretty much whatever they want. So, for example, Apple got pressure from the Obama administration, of Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton back then, banned the WikiLeaks app from its ecosystem. So all of a sudden, overnight, if you're an Apple iPhone user, you can't go on WikiLeaks anymore. Okay? That raises some really serious questions, because when the public forum is not privately operated, if those private corporations are not subject to any sort of regulation that forces them to act in the public interest, then where our society becomes at risk, because our freedom become, in practice, infringed upon. So I'm not saying that the First Amendment should apply to private corporations, but certainly we have to think about ways in which the public interest can be taken into consideration. Otherwise, our lives will be completely controlled by private interest, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. What's next for you?
So, I'm actually working on a book about it would be a legal history of the video game industry. Mm. I'm working on that, and then of course, you know, we have so people interested in internet law policy. I think the next 2 years are going to be very interesting, because things are far from being settled, right? So there's this vote coming up at the FCC in a couple of days. We'll see what happens. Most likely, they will roll back net neutrality, and that will open a flurry of lawsuits. And so I think for us and all involved in net neutrality, there's going to be work to do in the next coming years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for talking to me on this new books and technology.
Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Oh, no problem. I look forward to all the rest of your new work in law and policy and technology as well.
Great.
Now the interview with Kevin Driscoll. One of the things we always like to do on New Books in Technology is get a sense of who the author of the book is. So who is Kevin Driscoll?
Well, there's kind of two answers to this question, because there's who I am, my scholarly identity, and then how I came to the project. Mm-hmm. And they relate in kind of an unusual way. So I met my co-author, Julian Maland, in grad school. And we both were interested in technology and culture and policy. We were TAs together, things like that. But the genesis of the book actually came from outside of our scholarly interest to some extent, was in tinkering and playing around with older telecommunications systems. And it turned out that Minitel was really like a fun kind of technology to play with, that at the time it was not laden with nostalgia. So we were able to acquire lots of old materials and things like that to play with. And as we kind of discover through the book process, it was extremely well documented. So those two things come together to make a really generative context for play and experimentation. And that was something that kind of drives a lot of my scholarship, but isn't necessarily evident in the scholarly output.
Leading up until Minitel, the book,
yeah.
What kind of things were you writing about or studying?
Yeah, I'm generally interested in what it's like to live in a world that's kind of saturated, mediated through different sorts of communication and especially computation technologies. So at the time, I was especially interested in social media as a kind of platform for people to gather together and organize politically, and how computers and computer networks can bridge popular culture interests with political action. And so I was interested in people who get together to talk about TV shows on Twitter, then turning that into kind of a network that could become active politically. And so then that all of that work actually pushed me in a historical direction. So my dissertation research was about hobbyist and volunteer run community networks in the 1980s in North America. And that kind of gave me the orientation and some of the skills to work on the Minitel project.
Mm-hmm. So you just talked about political activism and some of the platforms. And I think, you know, Minitel offers kind of a perspective on that. One of the things I found interesting was, like, first that the Minitel existed, because I didn't know it existed.
Right.
But also that it was used, it was, I guess, advanced enough that people were able to form collectives and organize for activism.
Mm. I think the Minitel case, as with a lot of cases of computer networks in the 1980s, really challenges our expectations of what it means for a communication technology to be advanced. Mm-hmm. In the sense that it gave me appreciation for kinds of systems that simply carry messages reliably among people in across space. And in that sense, then most of the 20th century, we've had a variety of different networks and systems that people used to meet the social needs that they had at the time, whether that was CB radio or community FM stations or just telephone trees among activists. And the kind of cool thing about it is once you start looking at it in that way, then you see how we never quite abandon these technologies. They don't move in like a progress of abandoning and adopting, but they just kind of gather and aggregate over time. So the same, say, activist networks that might have used Minitel or dial-up bulletin board systems were also still, of course, organizing face-to-face and calling each other on the phone and making newsletters and Xeroxing them and things like that. Mm-hmm. So these systems, like, always are building out of the existing context and adding on to the practices that are already in place.
Now, one of the things that strikes me, as I said earlier, that I hadn't even heard of the Minitel. And I think one of the mythologies is that everything starts in the United States. And
yes.
I wonder if you could, like, discuss that with respect to the internet. And
absolutely.
Media.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had some experience as a primary school teacher before coming to grad school. And some of my classes were called computer science. And for a middle school student, that can also be a kind of a media literacy class. So we would talk about histories of the internet and where these systems come from. And you find a consensus around a very narrow and, I think, very unsatisfying story about how we would come to live in a world where so much of our economic and cultural and private, personal, even sexual activity is mediated through networks. Like, the story of networks like ARPANET gives us so little, it has like little explanatory power for how we could be in this world. Whereas Minitel, you do see people meeting and forming businesses and personal relationships and sexual relationships through computers. So it actually fills in this gap. The interesting part of it is why that story hadn't been so better known outside of France. And I think the kind of national or linguistic boundary isn't enough to explain it. Instead, it really rests on how the people in the United States and then exported to the world came to know the idea of the internet in the 1990s. And it was important that that story had been kind of sutured together with a story about private entrepreneurship and deregulation and light touch government control, things like that. And the Minitel story doesn't fit nicely into that pattern. So it easily fell out of the moment of grand kind of debut of internet and computer network mediated communications in towards the late 1990s.
An important feature, or perhaps, of the Minitel is that it was a government sponsored platform slash the actual hardware was given out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I think even in this current debate, in this current era, we're in the United States, at least, we're debating things like net neutrality, and people will assert, perhaps in error, that, you know, the government should never be involved with the internet. that you had this really successful platform that was a, you know, government backed, perhaps would be a mm-hmm. good way to explain it,
mm-hmm.
thing for the people.
Yeah. That, I mean, the way that you kind of conclude that observation that it's for the people is really important. That is particularly at the time, you could imagine the government making these decisions in the interest of the public, which for the time in France could be synonymous in some sense with like an identity around a nation, that they could feel themselves as a nation on the precipice. There has a fear of a national decline on the global stage. And so kind of like crisis action could be taken to make some big leap forward. And in a way, the Minitel is one of many grand projects undertaken by the state to try to push forward at the end of the 20th century. But in the bigger scheme of things, it kind of provokes us to think about this relationship of private and public, of state and corporate action in the development of new communication systems. And the Minitel case for us was really interesting because it challenged any sort of all or nothing dichotomies between these different poles, that you couldn't think Minitel as all government run, or you couldn't think the internet as all private. Once you start scratching away at the actual function of how the technologies work, it reveals itself to be hybrid, and you have to hold both in mind. And it for me, this is really productive, because then when you think about policymaking or try to imagine futures that you want to live in, you can imagine them as balances, and you can see how slight touches can shift balances in one direction or the other, versus the very simplistic way of thinking of things as like government bad, Silicon Valley good, or even vice versa.
Right. So I wonder if we could talk about the vote last week. So last week we had the Federal Communications Commission voting to repeal the open internet rules that were established in 2015. And I was wondering if what kind of, I don't know, lessons we can garner from the Minitel project in France that could possibly be guiding or offer guidance for us as we, you know, continue to debate whether or not to have some sort of regulation related to accessing of information and just, you know, people being able to get on the internet.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the advocates for repealing the Title II rules around how we govern broadband internet service providers in the United States are based on a story about the past that doesn't really bear out in any sort of empirical truth. And the story that is told is that up until some recent period, the government had no role in the regulation of internet service providers. And that's why the internet grew so well. And isn't it like a perfect demonstration of the free market? And what's so kind of strange about that is if you had used the internet during any period of that time, you either plugged your computer into the phone network and dialed a phone number, or you plugged it into a cable TV network, or you connected to some kind of radio tower. You were always using networks that came before the internet in order to access it. And there's no debate that the FCC has some responsibility to regulate our use of those telecommunications networks. And what's interesting about it is that from an FCC point of view, they're concerned about two kind of values that are in tension. And on one hand, there is stability and reliability. And on the other hand is innovation, the creation of new services and kind of private exploitation of the infrastructures. And the stability reliability part falls out of the kind of myth of the internet as this like radically unregulated system, because the internet grew because we had this incredibly stable, reliable telephone network pre-existing in the United States. So most of the early internet is carried over telephone wires that were laid to carry voice phone calls, not to carry data at all. We kind of retrofit them, and really through some ingenious engineering, we're able to reuse these telephone wires to carry data. And once I started thinking about the telephone network as a precondition for the internet, it reveals the hybridity of the internet in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the Minitel case helped me think about that a lot, because it was the failing French telephone network that prompted the creation of Minitel. That France had one of the worst telephone networks in Europe at the start of the 1970s. And so they endeavored to create a much better telephone network. And in doing so, it created the possibility of adding information services and data networks and things into the mix, like alongside growing the overall telephone network. So there, again, we see this balance between public interest and private exploitation. And so, you know, Julian and I kind of bounced that around a lot, thinking about how to describe this. And we started thinking about Minitel as a case of public infrastructure for private innovation, that by and large, the state only provided the platform for creating services. It didn't actually create any of the services. And something sort of similar happened around the beginnings of deregulation in the US, where the opening up of the telephone network enabled a lot of private innovation around it, like fax machines and answering machines, dial-up bulletin boards, and early internet service providers. But it wasn't that we like radically tore it all apart. There was still a balance, and the balance was about how much are you willing to sacrifice a little bit of the stability and reliability to get the innovation on the other hand. Mm-hmm. So it's clear that there's some role to play for a third party that we would call a state to regulate the activity here, and that is towards the continued production of new services and things like that. The other kind of component of the net neutrality story that I find so interesting is that the net neutrality story gets kind of applied up and down this stack of layers of activity, whether it's like actually putting wires onto telephone poles all the way up to how Facebook or Netflix behaves in the marketplace. And it's clear the FCC has some role at some point in that like gigantic mountain of activity, and maybe not at all levels, but to say that they have no role is kind of seems disingenuous to me. Mm-hmm. Here's a background story that I think helps me think through this. We know that towards the end of the 1990s, there was a lot of support for the production of new fiber optic networks. And one way to imagine the world that we would live in now is that we would all have fiber optic cables to our homes. That's not the world we live in. Instead, we have like jury-rigged networks that use coaxial cable that was laid to carry television content. Mm-hmm. And that's working pretty well for a lot of people, and the cable networks have been really good at making that work. But as a result, there are dark fiber networks in all these different parts of the country that just lay under the ground. In some cases, they would serve rural populations who are otherwise neglected, or it would be hard to profit from in a purely free market situation. And so it's clear that the system works well for people who are in particular socioeconomic and geographic locations relative to the whole population. And where state regulation steps in is to do that, to take care of the full system, to see it all in a kind of holistic, singular sense that everybody ought to be able to be connected in some way. And the example I always think back on is, it's not by natural consequence that everyone in the US could rent an apartment or buy a house and expect there to be phone jacks in the wall and expect to be able to have a phone number of their own. And yet we arrived at that situation by the early 1980s. What circumstances did it take to get to that point? And if that's something that we came to value, which did have a lot of positive consequences for the development of corporations and private enterprise, what's something analogous to that for the future going forward? What's something like a home phone number that we want to provide to people as a baseline that all families and small and businesses would be able to expect to have as we go forward? Mm-hmm. And I think that in the case of Minitel, there was something similar to that, which is they wanted everyone to have home telephone access. And if that was the goal, then why not? You also could access this information service. And the kind of hybridity of the network itself is that it used the telephone line to get you into the digital network. So they also didn't bring a packet switched connection to every home in France. The first step of your connecting to Minitel was to pick up the handset of your home telephone and dial into the local gateway, very similar to how we would have accessed a private internet service provider 10 or 15 years later.
Mm-hmm. So Minitel really didn't end till 2012, although there weren't obviously updates happening for a long time. But I was wondering, are there lessons from the perhaps decline / end of Minitel that all kinds of platforms and networks can take and use?
It's really provocative to think about the longevity of the network. Mm-hmm. You know, from a just simply hours per month sort of measure, the peak of Minitel is in the early 1990s, and yet it lasts for another two decades. Mm-hmm. And that was a topic of like fascination for people in France at the time. When Minitel finally ended, there were all of these articles in the newspaper like, we found the person in town that still uses Minitel and we interviewed them. You can kind of imagine that human interest story. So they send the photographer out to the farm and take pictures of this farmer with his Minitel like propped on the back of the pickup. And there is a humorous story that circulated a couple years ago where two teens like robbed a bodega and they were shouting to the guy like, let us have the safe. And he pointed to the back room and they ran in and grabbed his Minitel terminal and ran out of the bodega. And it was like a nationwide, you know, weird news story where they're saying the kids today don't even know what the Minitel is. It's only been closed for 3 years. So there's this longevity to Minitel that confounds our expectations of technologies being successive, that like a kid today has no idea what a modem sounds like. In fact, they do. And there are still infrastructures throughout the United States that depend on modems and telephone dial-ups, connections, and things like that. So the longevity of it, I think, is really interesting on a temporal level, but also on the scale of usage. Like, what do we think of as being mass media? And for example, in the United States, the use of broadband connections only overtook dial-up connections in about 2005, so just over 10 years ago. So in some ways, the internet of 10 or 15 years ago is almost like a different technology from the thing we use today, where people are connected through ubiquitous wireless broadband connections and things like that. But we're able to hold it in our minds as one thing. And so for Julian and I, we've tried to expand that even one step more and think of the period of time inclusive of Minitel and the present as being like one long era of building and diffusing these network communication technologies. And then we're able to see it as we're a transnational socio-technical phenomenon that's trying to deal with problems simultaneously in different ways at all times. Mm-hmm. And for some people, new technologies come and they don't actually meet any new needs, so they never adopt them. So for the person who is comfortable using Minitel and likes to go and chat with people in the chat rooms using the Minitel terminal, some of them never stopped. It was satisfying. It the new way of doing that didn't necessarily hold any appeal. And for me, that's just so exciting to think about how these things we make, they linger on and they have new lives that are really unpredictable to us. I should say also that Minitel is a medium for the state to connect to private citizens. So there's some state services that you had to access through Minitel, and they had to come up with some funny workarounds in order to continue to do that. So there was a period of time where you could download a Minitel emulator for your home computer. And so when you had to go to use a Minitel service, you would like fire up your virtual Minitel in your home computer and then connect to Minitel through the internet. So going in this like very strange recursive loop of telecommunication history in one moment to just register for classes or something like that.
Hmm. Wow. So one of the questions I have asked before on this show, and I think it bears asking again, particularly with this technology, the Minitel, is go to Langdon Winner and ask the question, do artifacts have politics? And do you think that this hardware / platform, the Minitel, had some kind of, you know, political ideology inherent in the system or in the way that it was used?
No doubt the Minitel is a political technology. I mean, just no doubt about it. What does it represent to take this machine, this strange box, and place it in your home, in your domestic space where you live and work and spend time with your family and things like that? That meant something significant. And the ambitions of the project to connect France first also reflect a political ideology of the maintenance of national identity. And that, I would say, is for better and worse. It reflects a way of thinking that was very inward facing, that was reflected in the structure of the network itself and how all connections and activities passed through some publicly managed part of the infrastructure on its way to another private end server on the other side. And these all reflected a way of thinking that was consistent with longer traditions in kind of like French political thinking. And I think that when you study how the networks get organized and how they grow throughout kind of the global information infrastructure, you often see reflections of the prevailing political ideologies of those places and times. Something that is striking about the Minitel case is how it is taken up in the present in nostalgia and by younger people. So, for example, about 10 years ago, there was a retro electro band in France called Minitel Rose that was like making it was an 80s band that had a name of Minitel. So Minitel for people living in France is an icon, like a symbol of a way of being in the 80s, the way that an American might think of like Zach Morris's cell phone or something like that. These like iconic devices that you might have actually not used that much. Like most people in France were required to use Minitel at least once in a while, but only some people adopted it to the full extent of it being a kind of social media system because it was expensive and it was weird. And if you didn't know anyone else who was using it, you may not have thought to use it yourself. But it represented a kind of building and making that was French, that was like oriented towards the experience of being French at this time. And for me as an American scholar, that's been the part of it that I've had to really do approach comparatively, to think about events and artifacts that we see and compare them against things that I've seen in other cases in order to really wrap my head around them.
So one of the things we always like to do on New Books in Technology is what we call the elevator pitch. So if there's someone out there who just, I don't know how, but tuned in just right now, and they want to know why they should purchase or read your book or, you know, preview it on, you know, Google Preview or whatever, perhaps you can take 1 minute and tell them why read Minitel, Welcome to the Internet.
Yeah, I mean, the way that we often approach it, it depends on your audience, right? Like there's a lot of curiosity in where these things come from. And the image that always comes to mind for me is somehow like 15 years before most people in the US were even thinking the word internet, there are millions of people in France who are using it every day to buy movie tickets, to flirt with other people, to find jobs, to do research, to carry out just their own personal hobbies and pursuits. And how could it be that on one hand, this system existed in the first place, and on the second hand, you've never heard of it? It tells a story that's both about technology and the production of history, how we come to know things or not know them about the past.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
So what's next for you, Kevin?
Well, this Minitel project came alongside some ongoing research I had been doing about hobbyist-driven computer networks. And so my main project now is about a parallel story taking place in North America, which is here we have popular computer networking through dial-up bulletin board systems. And dial-up BBSs are very local. They're very regional. Many of the people that use them know one another face-to-face. And there were over 100,000 dial-up bulletin board systems in North America, including in parts of the Caribbean, where people were building these community-oriented networks to trade files and chat with each other and things like that. And I think of the 100,000 systems all happening at the same time as a period of like crazy experimentation, where all these people are trying to figure out what it means to live and be among strangers online at the same time. And those folks end up being kinds of chaperones for the rest of us in the 1990s. They are the ones that introduce their friends, family, and neighbors to what it means to go online and what kind of pleasures and promises you might find by doing so. And that role of kind of the everyday person in bringing the internet into popular culture hasn't really been documented very well. And yet we have lots of evidence of it, and many of the people are still around to talk to. So that's what I've been working on recently.
Sounds cool. And hopefully you come back on New Books and Technology when that
yeah, that would be cool.
Great. Well, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
This has been New Books and Technology. Have a happy holidays.